This is day four of the 5-day May-June retreat in England. It is wondrous just listening to the rain, isn't it? Here are some of the questions that I wrote down. Can you say something about reincarnation? A good friend of mine committed suicide. And it helps me to think that in another life, she will have another chance. Why do you keep your eyes down while you talk? I'd prefer you to look at me. There are many me's here. Then there would be less distance between us. Before I forget, let's talk quickly about this. Actually, in talking and keeping the eyes closed, I don't feel any distance from you. I'm not just saying that, it's true, I don't. And it's easier for me to talk and to look at what I'm saying by keeping the eyes closed. There are 40 people here, sometimes there are more, and who shall I look at? Often looking, there's all kinds of things going on. We talked in the beginning about eye contact. We want approval from another and are afraid of disapproval. And the brain is part of the eye. It comes right into the back of the eye, the brain, part of the brain. And such a quick association with looking around. Whereas the field is quiet and free and open in looking without looking at what I'm to say, without looking around. Part of it may be habit too. To come to an individual meeting, we can have a lot of eye contact. Even though if I really need to look at something you're asking or saying, then I may close my eyes there too. But it's there's not so many people and it's just one. Also, experiment with it yourself, whether the listening has an inwardness about it when the eyes are closed and not looking around. I'm also listening, not just talking. Many people in listening to talks don't look at me. They often look inwardly. But I'm not requesting that people look down. And if they wish to look at me, that's all right. As for the distance one feels, what is that? Is it the distance of wanting? And no fulfillment of that want? And therefore a feeling of separation, isolation. We have to find out for ourselves. Everything is worth questioning and looking at and wondering about, even if we have no immediate answer. Don't we need a teaching and a teacher and a tradition at certain stages of our spiritual path? Maybe later on we can do without it. Maybe you or Krishnamurti can do without it, but can I? Why divide between us? You, Krishnamurti, in comparison to me, we're all human beings. The same brain processes, the same emotional processes, and the same link between them. The same yearning for refuge and guidance, the security of that, the comfort of it. And the assumption that maybe later on in the future I can do without it. How do we know? We may be more dependent in the future. To come like here to listen to a person, to give a talk and hold meetings, group meetings, and see whether we can see something together, raise a question together and probe it, plumb it, go deeply into it together. Maybe helpful. Somebody speaks with a fairly clear mind. That may be helpful. Or reading the writings of someone with a clear mind. Can that also clarify this mind, the reading mind? Because the writer of the book wrote out of a clear mind. It may have some helping effect, a catalytic effect, sometimes it's said, or a mirroring. As for the tradition, I've given my answer. It's up to you whether you feel you need it, and this is up to you. I don't feel a need for it. I feel great freedom without it. I have to watch what I was saying so as not to offend the tradition or those who were identified with it. But to read something, somebody asked once, what is the function of reading scriptures? Well, find out what function it has. Does it function as a dogma, indoctrination, or in reading something suddenly clears up, becomes crystal clear in the mind and body. The mind and body are not separate. Or is one reading to feel a refuge, again, a comfort? I'm not saying one is right, the other is wrong. One is that, the other is this. Not to assume anything about the future. The future only exists in our imagination, nowhere else. That's only this moment. And the whole past is embedded in it as memory and conditioned responses that arise from this memory. Some of them are thinking about the future, how free I will be if I do this or that. Who knows? Can there be freedom now in looking and listening to the words, to the rain, to the inner movements of thought and emotion? Free to look, free from fear. Not afraid to look at fear. Allow it to be felt, heard, seen, as it unfolds when the mind is really willing to look. Not afraid of pain or I'm living a rather solitary life together with my two children. I practice a lot at home, meditation, and go to retreats, but I'm also concerned that I may enclose my children into this solitude and become dependent upon them as my company. Am I dividing my spiritual practice from the rest of my life? Here is my spiritual practice which I'm trying to protect from distraction. And there is my daily life, which is the distraction of my spiritual life. 10. This is my question. Can what is commonly called spiritual practice include all distractions? As we said repeatedly, nothing unworthy of being listened to or paid attention, given attention. The disturbance at being distracted, worthy, it's worthy of being looked at and allowed to unfold and observed and wondered about. A woman once came to me many years ago. She was the head cook at a spiritual center where only people with considered to have great spiritual strength were given the job of a head cook. No ordinary one was given that job. You had to have proven yourself to be advanced in your practice, past koans or whatever. And she came to see me. We hadn't seen each other since I had left the center. I was happy to see her. And she came for a visit, but she was very distraught, depressed, and immediately broke into tears, convulsive crying. What had happened was that her friend, boyfriend, and companion of many years had left her for another woman. And the pain of it was almost unbearable to her. And then out of sobbing, she said, what is the worst thing about it? That my spiritual practice has fallen apart. And all I could ask was, isn't this falling apart your spiritual practice? I usually don't use those words. All I say is, look at it. Listen to it. Meet it gently. Completely. Without ideas about me falling apart. This is not my spiritual practice, but that is. How we constantly divide this life, which is undivided in itself, by our ideas. Can we begin to learn about it and learn as we go? With that, intelligence comes into being. I became aware this morning that I was blaming myself for taking two tea bags out at the same time, then for being too lazy to separate them, and so on. Constantly blaming myself for something. And then one blames oneself for blaming oneself. Can you say something about this habit of constantly blaming oneself? Say a lot about it, but the briefest is question it as this person is doing. Question it. The usefulness of it, the effect of it. Watch it arise and watch what it does. Enclose us in this solitary confinement of blame. Or isolating us from others by blaming them. It's more common even probably than blaming oneself, it's blaming others. This would be such a tremendous relief if we could begin to abstain from blaming as we understand about it and try to understand what it is that's happening. This leads to that, and that leads to this. Experience, see it in our own life. Who are we going to blame? Our parents, their parents, our great-grandparents, Adam and Eve? It's one stream of happening, and we're part of this stream of human history, of conditions, responses conditioning each other and not knowing what we're doing. This stream manifests in each one of us. And that stream also includes the program of blaming ourselves and others. I grew up this way with a lot of guilt feelings. It was part of the cultural conditioning of my family. There's a saying in German, to heap fiery coals on someone's head. It means always make everyone feel a little bit guilty. It's not deliberate, it's also automatic. And feeling guilty, having done something wrong, one is very malleable because one wants the love and approval of the parents. If I feel guilty and am so conditioned, I will try to really oblige. Be good. Do what you say. And having learned this, then if one does not watch, and usually we don't watch very closely, we continue it with our own children, our husband, wife, friends. Make them feel a little guilty so we get our way or have a more, what seems malleable relationship, influencing each other through guilt. And blame, because blame can be a release of accumulated upset and irritation. That doesn't help, does it? It goes on and on and on, and it does not reveal anything that's underlying the irritation. Why do I get irritated in the first place? Is it that I didn't get my way? What one can ask oneself in this manner. One just feels very irritated and sits down with it. Or it comes up during sitting. The remembrance of an incident that now creates the same irritation that happened before. Why do I get so irritated at thinking about what he said or she did? Why? And one can ask that. When we did this in one meeting, the person was surprised that I thought we shouldn't be thinking while sitting. There's no should or shouldn't. If something bothers you, nags, then go into it. Try to open it up. And it can be very helpful to have sort of some dialoguing with oneself. Why do I get so irritated? And then pause, not immediately, well, it's because of this. That's too automatic, too quick. Let the question just hang there, resonate throughout the body-mind, and things will come up. And then you look at it, what comes up. Is that why I got irritated? Yeah, some of it is like that, but this is not the whole thing. There's some more, so you ask again and be quiet. Is it that I didn't get what I wanted, I didn't get my way. My way was crossed. What is my way? You see how you can probe and go deeper? Into oneself. I don't mean analytically, but existentially. as things come up, you question it and let more come up, which it will. The mind is open and interested and willing to face what comes up. May not be a quiet hour, but it may be a very revealing hour. Revealing about not just this human being who is questioning here, but about all of us. Because we're so similar in our irritations. Not getting our way, or our image hurt. Trying to protect our image. Why? What for? What is it? Why this attachment to my image? Many people are questioning this, have brought questions about it or understanding. Why this attachment to the images I have created about myself or others have created and I live up to them? One person said, I'm usually happy. And then added, because I've always been told that I'm a happy person. Is one living up to the image of being happy and dare not show sadness? Because that would hurt the image in other people's eyes, make one feel guilty that one is not happy for the expectation of others? There's so much to look at. Not to correct or to blame or to change, but to throw light on it. Become more intelligent about our inner and outer functioning. I like your talk, but I don't feel you are going far enough. I don't remember now what it was. I couldn't remember what it was that was brought up as not going far enough. But if you feel I'm not going far enough, then let's do it together. Let's go farther. Tell me what it is you want to go into and that you felt was not touched by the talk. We'll see what happens. Sometimes people say, you're going too far. Go slowly. I'm trying to go slowly. Often I'm talking so fast. There's too much maybe said too quickly to really follow it. Not just verbally, intellectually, but to look. So I wish sometimes there would be a possibility somebody saying, go a little bit slower, or just make a beep. But I do also at times remind myself to pause in between and say things slowly. Because it is an arduous thing not just to follow intellectually, but to look at the same time as we listen to a talk. Looking whether this is so, can I see it for myself? When I become aware of something vague in myself, putting it into explicit words seems to help the intellect as well as help in the focusing of what is happening. Person said also, I'm very interested that you said it helps if the intellect is clear about something, is thinking clearly. And is this putting something into explicit words, is this part of the intellectual clarification? And the person also said it does help to focus on something more clearly. It was sort of vague before, brings it more into focus. And then we got sort of, it was in a group, into a discussion about focusing. A lot of meditation practice, We didn't say all of this in that meeting, but we'll go freshly into it now. I hope you're interested. A lot of meditation practice is focusing practice, particularly in the beginning. Focus on the breathing, focus the breathing on an area in the body, different for different traditions. For some, between the eyes, the focus is to be put between the eyes, the physical. For some, the tip of the nose. In the Zen tradition, it's the area 4 fingers below the navel. To put the attention there and observe the breathing there. Focusing on a special area of the body which is said to have particular significance for the progress in meditation or concentration. I've done this for many years, focusing on this area here. And done it with people who were doing the same thing, encouraged and admonished to do that. Have more hara, as it's called in Japanese, this area is called hara. And all kinds of extra stuff goes on with whenever we try to do something that doesn't come naturally. For a while I called it the elevator effect, up and down, thinking, am I in my hara? Then I was up. For a moment in the hara, then I was down. Am I... And a lot of people have confirmed that same thing, constantly checking on oneself. And then when it seems to sit there with a little bit of stability, then comes the hara pride. One's got it. And walks around with a hara. There's something to this area. I think all of the martial arts sort of come out of there. There's a lot of teaching to have concentration there. And before even coming to the Zen tradition, I was had a voice training to sing and had to concentrate on this area. I mean, this is where the support was for the voice. You weren't to sing from your vocal cords. Because for that kind of singing that I studied, you don't hold a microphone in your hand to amplify your voice. It has to come, the support has to come out of your own body. And it comes from this diaphragm. And yet I did struggle. It was not quite that it was very hard to put the attention there and watch the breathing. And of course, the struggle and then feeling one has it in comparison with others is not conducive to an open awareness of this very process going on. Because whenever we try to do something, we may be successful, but are we aware of this whole process of trying, what that is doing, and the whole success-failure syndrome, what it does to us, how it divides us from ourselves and each other. And of course, it is always said that eventually this will all go away, the focus, it'll be all open, or just like somebody said, wouldn't eventually I not need the dependence on tradition or teachers or whatever. But once a habit is established, it's there, it's in place. And people who have now come to the center in Springwater or work with me elsewhere. I've done it, worked with people for, I don't know, 76 I started, 86, 15 years. And I still voice my koan, even though I try to listen, there's still this habit of voicing the koan in my belly or straining the belly, concentrating on it. Even though I'm not intending to do it, it's automatic now, it's in place. Trying to get somewhere by straining the belly. Oh, concentrating the breath into a certain place of the body. Now somebody this morning said, you know, the way when I practiced, it was very fine and it was opening and the concentrated part disappeared. If that happens, then maybe it's no habit, but has one watched it carefully, subtly? Because sometimes what we think happens is not what really happens. It takes very subtle attention to catch all the subtle habits that pervade this body-mind and have pervaded it for thousands of years. So, focusing on the breathing. That's how I taught when I started teaching at the Zen Center. Start counting inhalation, exhalation, and then just exhalation, 1 to 10 and so forth, and then progress to just observing the breathing, and then progress to just observing a koan. But with always a measure of concentration in that, of focusing, which never brought, except maybe for split seconds, the openness of questioning and looking without a focus, just whatever's there. There are all kinds of advantages to being able to focus the mind, to concentrate it, to pay attention. It makes for great scientists and observers everywhere. The people skiing down a slope, we watched it on television, was incredible. In Albertville, the slope, how can anybody go down there? Must be incredible concentration. To the point of self-abandonment until when it's down at the bottom of the hill and looks up what the score is. Then there's the self again. Did I win? Did I do better? But to dive backwards, just the toes holding on to the diving board, one can see in the athletes tremendous concentration. Ice skating, you name it, it's all great concentration in the athletes. So there's a place for it. And again, it's often said, first learn to concentrate the mind so it can be open later on. I don't subscribe to that. Very often, when the mind has learned to concentrate, it doesn't want to open anymore. It's more comfortable or secure or powerful, energetic to be concentrating. There are so many rewards that have come from it and are coming from it. Plus, just the unawareness of the habit itself. People who've never concentrated, have never practiced it, often understand very quickly what is meant to listen openly, because they have no old habits that get in the way. It's usually people who have practiced a lot who said, it's so chaotic when I let go of the practice, and my mind is all over the place. It's for everyone, also for the one who hasn't practiced, but that person doesn't consider that as the false state of mind. It's something that's there to be with, like the rain that falls everywhere, makes all the leaves and stones glisten. So, if you're interested, experiment with it, that the mind has no focus whatsoever. Which doesn't mean I must not pay attention to the breathing, because it's there. It's always there. That's the beauty of it. Whether we're aware of it or not, it's there. If I wake up from a fantasy, there's the breathing. There's the rain. There are physical sensations. There are all kinds of thoughts I should have concentrated or whatever. Let it all be there. There is space for it. need no antagonism. Nothing is a distraction if it is allowed just to be seen and felt and heard without much ado. That's the art of living. Meeting everything without much ado. Not making something out of everything. Good, bad, important, unimportant. The art of being in touch with it and then letting it go, which it will if the mind doesn't begin to make something out of it. And what it makes out of it is how it relates to me. Good for me, bad for me, and mine, of course, I include in me whatever I'm identified with, my family, my friends, my religious group, my political party, my country, whatever. That is what every incident is sort of related through spinning thoughts to my existence. Watch it. I'm not indoctrinating you, I hope. I'm just offering something for observation, which I've observed myself, in myself. I'm not repeating what other people tell me. I'm looking at it myself. One person said, if you were to die, what would you say to someone at that stage, at that moment? And what he was asking is, what is the essence of your teaching? What would you say the moment you die? Oh, I don't know. I don't know right now. I'm not dying. But what I'm wondering, if a question like this comes up, is what will be the state of mind at the moment of dying? Of course, I don't know either. But what is important? Is it important of what someone says or what someone manifests at the moment of dying? The essence of this work, what I call this work, is not the best word either. I don't like the word teaching because of the associations, and people tell me the word work is just as bad. It has associations of blood, sweat, and tears. So the essence of all this talking, what is it? Living or dying? Is it listening to the rain? Or listening, not to the rain, listening, and there's the rain. There is this body throbbing with aliveness. There are people here. Clouds, airplanes, trees, cool draft through the window, breathing, that's all there. Is that the essence? See, what does a question like that do? Is that all? Is there something more? In the moment you say something, what does it become in the mind of the listener? Something to achieve, to attain? But in listening right now, is there any attainment Are these words, are these, whatever that is there, streams of rain, are those words? And the quality of the listening, what is it? What is the essence of listening? I can say no division, no sense of distance whatsoever, but is that real? Or is it just small words to the ear? Or is there really no sense of distance? And if there is a self sense of distance, what is it? To allow it to be felt, seen, heard, for what it is, not condemned, not fought. Nothing needs to be fought. Everything is what it is. What is it? Last night it hit me like a ton of bricks that what I have been holding on to in my life is my spiritual practice. If anything else went wrong in my life, then there was always my spiritual practice that I could hold on to as my comfort. Now, suddenly, this whole thing has collapsed. I've seen it for a powerful fantasy, and I don't think I'll ever be the same. It'll ever be the same again. Now everything looks so frighteningly ordinary. Not just ordinary, but frighteningly ordinary. Like there's nothing meaningful anymore. When this happens, as it happens to us when an illusion breaks apart, like the woman, her lover left her, she probably assumed he'd be there forever, and the feeling of everything falling apart, what one has held on to as one's refuge and comfort, stimulation. Person said, I only need to think, I have a spiritual practice. And with that thought, energy, chemicals are released in the body, which transmit all kinds of information and energies to organs and muscles throughout the body. One person I remember long years ago giving her the koan mu, which is the first koan you get in the Zen practice. At the end of the retreat, she says, now come hell or high water, I don't worry anymore. I got my move. Faith in something. When I think of it, it sends good energy throughout my body. Because if one watches what thoughts about nice things or hopeful things or good things to happen in the future, what they do, if one begins to observe this, one sees it's not the holy or the sacred that is touching one, but thoughts elicit all kinds of good or anxious feelings throughout the body. And now this thought is shattered, thought of whatever one has put in as hope or into this concept of spiritual practice, because it's just a concept that is being abandoned or has been seen through, because they can always listen to the rain. right now. But this doesn't count as spiritual practice, maybe. It's something glowing in the mind that will happen to me in the future, the past, from here to there. My important occupation or task lends meaning to my life as I think about my life. Because listening to the rain right now has complete meaning in itself. It doesn't point toward anything else. It's just this. So, if this happens, the collapse of an elaborate structure that has given refuge, comfort, positive energies, meaning to my life, and now it's collapsed and everything looks so frightfully ordinary. Scarily, that's what was meant. Scarily ordinary. Lackluster ordinary. Can one remain with this? With this present state? Allow it to be felt, seen, heard, the senses open to it. And not search for something else. Just be with it. Quietly, openly, as open as possible. Or if there's closedness, be with a closedness. Not interpret the state of being. Because we don't know what it is, and the interpretation is no help. It's not needed. Things are what they are this instant. What are they? Have we ever looked at anything ordinary without wanting it to be otherwise? Looked at a wet shoe. Just the way it is, feels, smells, looks, without wanting, without fearing, or if want and fear comes up, that's all part of this wet shoe. We can't know what everything is, but here it is. It's the mind expecting, according to fantasies, what will happen, or expecting nothing. And therefore in touch with what is now, not the fantasy about tomorrow. The thinking feeling or the rising feeling. To look at inside, outside, without knowing what it should be, or could be, or has been. Just, what is it? Huh? I don't know what it is, but there it is. We will end here for today.
Thank you for listening. To learn how you can support the teachers and Dharma Seed, please visit dharmaseed.org/donate.